Flatiron Health sponsors this episode. Their mission is to improve the lives of cancer patients by helping oncologists spend more time with patients and empowering scientists to conduct research faster. To achieve these goals, they're looking for bright, curious, and passionate people to join the team. With roles across engineering, sales, and data science, join Flatiron in building tech for good. The link is in the show notes.
Yo, everyone, welcome back. Brand new Techish in the building. It's me, Michael Verheyen, and I'm joined with the amazing...
Obsessive!
Welcome to brand new Techish. Let's get it cracking. So for the first story, I think I want to give a shout out to Andreessen Horowitz. So they are colloquially known as A16Z. They have made out like bandits off this Coinbase IPO. I mean, I called it an IPO last time, but it's not technically an IPO. It's a direct listing, and I won't go into the difference. It's a bit of an esoteric difference. It's basically not a traditional... IPO process, you kind of bypass a bank. But anyway, so Andreessen have made a whole bunch of money. Their shares now are worth $9.7 billion. And it's actually one of the biggest paper returns.
Who shares?
Andreessen Horowitz.
Their shares in Coinbase?
Yeah.
$9.7 billion.
Yeah, it's one of the biggest paper returns in the history of VC from a single company investment.
Wow.
And that's that amount of capital represents half the amount of capital they raised in the first 12 years. But the thing about Andreessen is that actually up until this point, people were saying how like their returns don't match the hype because they're very good with the hype. Like, you know, they've got a good public image. They're quite famous. They've got a podcast that I used to listen to. And
Great content. Great books.
Like, great books. Like, they're quite prominent, you know. But actually, when people looked into their returns, it wasn't really cutting it, or it was average, to say the least. Now, this one investment has turned it around. And why I give them credit is because they doubled down during the kind of crypto winter of 2018. If you remember now, if you're a bit younger, you're probably going to be like, crypto's always gone up. But at one point, crypto just dropped like a rock. In 2018, I remember everyone was like, God damn, it's over. This whole thing's a bubble, basically. And at that point, they doubled down and invested a whole bunch more in Coinbase, and it's paid off for them. You know what I mean? So if you listen to other episodes, we've probably been critical of all of the players involved in this kind of story. But I will give credit where credit's due, in a sense that I respect people that double down when everyone is saying, no, this ain't going to work. Like, oh, this is now BS, basically. It's easy to double down when the hype is going for you, when everyone says, oh my God, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread, you're a genius, whatever. So it does make me question my assessment of Clubhouse, because I have been quite critical of Clubhouse's future prospects. Yeah, so, and they have doubled down. Yeah, they've doubled down now and given Clubhouse a $4 billion valuation, apparently, which is insane. But listen, they're contrarians. They might see something that I'm not seeing. So shout out to them. Like, what's your thoughts?
I mean, I've been seeing something you ain't seeing.
You should apply to work there then. You might be the kind of visionary they need. That's the kind of visionary they need. Like, you know what I'm saying? Not me, little old me, calling the shots incorrectly. I mean, we'll see. I've got one stat here before you go on Clubhouse.
Oh, here we go.
On Clubhouse, which I
should... Your confirmation bias is showing.
This is the thing about the internet, yeah. It just shows you stuff when you already believe it. But anyway, so Clubhouse installs... February, 9.6 million, yeah. March, 2.6 million. And April, to date, so far, 600K. Now, it's only going in one direction as far as I can see. But, I don't know, Abba, what is the thesis then? If you see downloads going dropping like a rock, okay, you and Andreessen are seeing something that I'm not seeing. There's clones galore. We're going to talk about that later. What's going on here?
So, we know that Clubhouse was like... kind of taken to town for scaling too quickly and crashing a lot. This really annoyed some of the power users, some of the oldest people in the community. The founders held their hands up and they're just like, okay, yeah, we were like focusing way too much on growing. Let's remind ourselves, it is still iOS only as of now. Mm-hmm. And it is still also by invitation only. Growth is sometimes a vanity metric, right? Let's remember that. It's not just about growth when it comes to apps. It's about engagement. What is the average time that a user is spending on the app? These things are like far more critical and important. And we also have to remember that ultimately, they are going to be moving towards some kind of monetization model for the creators on the platform. And if you have the right people on the platform who are ready to pay, it doesn't matter how many of them you have, as long as you have the right ones. Yeah. So I think, you know, there are a lot of people that want Clubhouse to fail. Hey, literally when the first pre-seed or whatever was announced, I was one of those people that was extremely dubious. But as the world goes on and my understanding of what the capacity is for this platform in terms of like live, full stop, evolves, I'm definitely super bullish about it. And I don't think it's like Andreessen Horowitz knows something that we don't know. I mean, yeah, okay, sure. They probably have access to data that we can't see. And over the long period of time through modeling and all these fancy things, as well as existing exits they have and data sets, they can probably like, yeah, make a few predictions for how the product can evolve and the market will grow. But Yeah, I don't actually think there's that much like wizardry or magic within VC. Like, I think they like to create that mystique because that adds to the legacy of the brand and that gives them a competitive advantage. You know, oh, do you want to go with Sequoia? Do you want to go to Kleiner Perkins or like whatever, whatever. But at the end of the day, I do just think Clubhouse has an opportunity for the way entertainment and the creator economy is going to be relevant real estate in that space. And that's what they're bullish about.
Yeah.
The creator economy is huge. It's huge. And it's like super nascent.
I think
market.
It is very nascent, despite how big it is. Jake Paul basically won a boxing match. I hate to bring up the Paul brothers. But
what?
Yeah, he basically beat a professional boxer just now. So the creator economy.
He won it.
Yeah. And he's made more money in that fight than like most professional boxers will ever make. So the creator economy, the YouTube economy, the whatever economy is going strong. But I personally, back to Clubhouse, I personally think they are seeing something in regards to how sticky the product is. Anecdotally, I don't think the product is that sticky. I've seen a lot of tweets, people saying like, who logged in and never logged back in again, basically. And it's got like thousands and thousands of retweets. But that could be, you know, that's not science. That's not real data. That's just kind of...
And that's what I was saying. It doesn't matter, right? Like there are people that open Instagram once and never come back again. But there are also a lot of people that spend more time on Instagram than they do talking to their loved ones on any given day, right?
Yeah.
So that's what really matters. Like what is happening with the people really engaged with the product? And are they willing to keep coming back to it? Yes. Do they trust it? Yes. Are they willing to spend money to access people that create content on it? Yes. Okay, cool. Awesome. Let's move.
You know what?
You know, they're probably going to, in the future, have partnerships with record labels. So many opportunities. Gamer. Like, yeah. I feel like the possibilities are endless.
And you know what? If I was the head of Clubhouse right now, I'd be trying to hire whoever is the alchemist at TikTok. Because I downloaded TikTok for work. I was like, okay, I need to download TikTok because like, you know, sometimes you want to repost some great content for Pocket. And I was like, I'll just be on it for like 5 minutes. Bro, it was like an hour later. I was like, what is going on here, bro?
Dude.
Like you just start scrolling like a zombie. And I was like, I got
to delete that thing.
Yeah, I deleted it. I was like, what the hell is going on here? Yeah, I thought, nah, I'm
old. That is an app I do not allow to stay on my phone. I do not have the discipline for that. At the end of the day, I still have a reptile brain. Like you give me something I like, you make me laugh. You give me like a little dopamine hit. I can keep scrolling. Oh Lord, it's going to be hard to get me off that platform. I have to delete TikTok.
Yeah.
Like, just at regular intervals because I'm literally, I also like as much as I love it, it is the kind of app that I worry is making me dumber.
Absolutely. So much fake news on there. I watched that.
Because I can just end up going down some random ass things where I'm just like, what am I even reading or listening to? Or this, like, what is this infographic about? Like, oh, stop, go away, read a book.
But if I was a CEO of a large like social platform, I'd be like, I need to get the product managers and the alchemists at the company to join mine. I'm trying to get you guys now.
So I saw a really interesting post from Taylor Sky. We've spoken about her in the show before because she did an amazing Twitter thread a few years ago sharing basically how she got into the engineering role that she was in and sharing all of her comp and also sharing what she was compensated for side consulting jobs and faced a huge backlash.
Ooh,
a lot of people thought that she was showing off. And I just was really frustrated with that. I just felt the abuse was completely unnecessary. But hey, another day in patriarchy. So what do you do? Anywho, I was on Instagram today and she put this post out. It really resonated. And I could see the comments were popping. And I just, you know, these shifted mindsets and shifted perspectives that have happened during the pandemic that we can't necessarily let go of. So what she was saying is that she feels like lockdown has made her feel like every hobby can be turned into a side hustle. And, you know, we've seen it, right? Like we've seen people launching stores, consulting, Instagram, TikTok influencers, brand partnerships. Everyone's a creator now, right?
Yeah.
And what she says is, I don't think I've ever interviewed in as many jobs before in my life. And I've saved so much money during lockdown. But at the same time, I feel like I'm on the hamster wheel. I don't want, you know, any thoughts. And I was just wondering, you know, this is really interesting because the way that I see it, all this time that we've had on our own, at home, with no obligations to family, social life, hobbies, whatever, we have in this hyper-capitalism, advanced stage capitalism that we're in, realized that we can actually convert a lot of this time into money.
Yeah.
Whether that's, oh, here's my skill, let me show it off. Let me build something, let me sell it. And it's never been easier to jump into e-commerce thanks to technology and everything that it exists. But what we forget is that like, it is also like addictive, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Just building on that conversation we're having around crypto and stuff like that, like making money feels good. You know, it's like choices and it's this and it's that. So are people now stuck in this mindset where it's just like, I could be making money. I could be monetizing that. Mm-hmm. I could be selling this. Mm-hmm. I could be, and where does that lead, or how do we escape it?
I don't know how we escape it. I'm not sure if it's like a lot of people that are going through this. I think it's like, maybe we're kind of in that type A personality circle where everyone's entrepreneur and everyone's like,
but you, digital natives, yeah. Techies, side hustlers, yeah.
Entrepreneurial people, basically. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how we escape it, but it is really troubling, because I think when you're doing something for the enjoyment and you're kind of in that flow state, you can, you know, you can live quite a rewarding, happy life that way. When they ask people what is their happiest moments, they're all like flow state activities, whether that's swimming, skiing, you know, being with somebody, cracking joke, right? You know what I'm saying? And when you put that thing of let's make money, it just activates a different part of your brain and it takes you out of the moment, because then you're like, how will people respond to my painting? How will people respond to what I'm doing, as opposed to let me just enjoy what I'm doing? Mm. Do you know what I'm saying? So you deprive yourself of that space just to be happy, because that is where happiness actually lies, just being present and doing something for the sake of it. And it happens in all aspects of life. Like, it's not a money making thing, but I remember reading about how if you want to be happy with your money, you should spend it on experiences, not things, because with experiences, especially with your friends, it's more enjoyable. So holidays are actually better for your happiness than, you know, a new Gucci belt or whatever, theoretically. But if you're, now we go on holiday to show people that we're going on holiday. Now we go on holiday to remind others that I'm living better than you. And it's another aspect of thievery. Now, your mind is elsewhere. Your mind is no longer, how do I enjoy this view? My mind is, let me make sure I take a picture of this view so that other motherfuckers can see they ain't got this view. I've got this view. You know what I'm saying? And you might not be thinking that consciously, but that is there. Like, the brain is very clever. Like, it understands, like, because you activate that social wiring in your brain, which is like, yo, what do people think of me? Mm-hmm. How do I make other people like me? And that's the same for side hustles. That's the same for taking pictures on holiday. And yeah, it's weird. I don't know what to do about that. You just got to disconnect as much as possible. The only way is to save yourself is by disconnect from everything. Like, shut your laptop down, turn your phone off. Just, if you like painting, paint. If you like singing, sing. If you like, you know, whatever, drawing, draw. Like, forget, you know what I mean?
It's not just about the disconnect. Well, I wholeheartedly agree. And, you know, for the record, that life is better when you invest in experiences. Yeah, fine. If you already have like a good bed, a good chair to work from.
Yeah, definitely.
From.
Yeah, if you got money.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like have like some cashmere socks and like silk pajamas. Get the essentials that you are in and using all the time up to a standard where you can live your good life, and then maybe invest experiences. And exactly to your point, the experience does not need to be 7-course tasting menu, 5-star hotel. It can literally just be go for a walk, have a nice little picnic. So I definitely think there's a lot of brands that emerged over the last 10-20 years that really took that millennials love experiences thing to the nth degree, and that was just like their whole friggin' go-to-market strategy. Yes. Invest in experiences. Like, look, I love Airbnb, but let's face it, that's one of their big things. So anyway, just gonna like put that to one side. It's not just about disconnecting. I think each of us as individuals in this brave new world need to have the discipline to define what is important to us. Mm-hmm. And that is where social media becomes dangerous, because you start to judge your expectations, your actions, your achievements by standards other people are proposing onto you. Like, it doesn't matter what that influencer that you love, that model on the cover of Vogue, that director that just won an Oscar is doing with their life, because they're an individual on their own path, on their own journey. And what is your path? What is your journey? And I think that is where, unfortunately, people are getting a bit unstuck, because a journey and a path cannot be to earn a lot of money.
Yeah.
That's not a purpose in life. You know, like, you need a purpose in life. That might be a tool to help you achieve your purpose. You want to go back to your country, build schools, orphanages, whatever. Okay, I get you. But that chasing of the dream, the chase can't be the purpose. And I just think people need to have that discipline and really be like, why am I doing this? And what am I about?
Yeah. Hey, hey. Everybody that wants to retire wealthy or retire with a nice little bundle has to be responsible with their investments, right? You know what I'm saying? You got to have your S&P 500. You got to have a little, maybe a bit of property, whatever you want to do, right? Obviously, this is a very privileged conversation, but you know, if you want to retire nicely, but don't forget your meme-inspired crypto token, because Dogecoin has done 5,000% since the start of the year. And you know what?
Woof, woof.
So that if you put in 10K at the beginning of the year, we'd have $500,000 right now. And the whole thing started as a joke.
You're going to be balling to put 10K into a meme coin. But anyway, continue.
But you know what? So basically, in 2017, during the crypto hype, I put in, I think, about a couple hundred quid into like a bunch of different...
That's what I bought too.
Yeah, I put in a couple hundred quid into like a bunch of these, like, just I think like 10 different tokens. I was like, fuck it, I'm gonna pretend to be an angel investor. I'm just gonna, you know, spread my bet to see what happens. I logged in today. I was like, yo, this thing did, it's not crazy money, but it's healthy. This is a nice little holiday. What's going on here?
Dude. Shout out to Doge. You got some like 4, 5, 10x returns up from there.
Yeah,
like, better than your savings account.
Basically. So what does it say about the world though, where you could be a responsible 65-year-old right now and you've saved up a lot of money and some kid just bypassed you because he just put in a little sign into a meme coin that has no probably any intrinsic value.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, there's so much volatility in this market. You know, like the rational thinker in me is just like still not ready to put like a significant portion of my disposable income into this type of asset. It's kind of crazy. But it does show how capitalism has evolved once again. You know, we get it now. Like value is not something that is intrinsic. Mm. Unfortunately, right? It's not innate. It's not like defined by the existence of a specific thing. In fact, value is something that is a state of flux. Sometimes it's even friggin' ephemeral, as we're learning with NFTs and that are plummeting in value, and cryptos that are high one day and low the next. So we are starting to use this to our advantage as consumer investors. Look, we've been spending a lot of time at home, a lot of time on the internet. We're like in year two of a lockdown pandemic situation. We got to have fun somehow. And I think, you know, real crypto heads are seeing the opportunity. Speculative investors are also starting to see the opportunity a bit and just kind of go, okay, let's play around a little bit here, drive things up, short sell, whatever. Yeah. It's a game. It's a game that more and more people can now access thanks to technology, thanks to Wi-Fi. And it's also, you know, in terms of like how we give things value, because value is something that is ultimately, you know, a projection, a manifestation of us and our, you know, combined desires and wills. I think we also see people gaming this a bit. You know, it's kind of like the whole GameStop thing and like the Reddit investors. Like, I do feel like the crypto world is very much a place where power players make moves to benefit in some way. Like we talked in the past about Bitcoin and like Tesla's investment in Bitcoin. Look, I'm by no means a crypto head, but I do just see this as a space that is like very easily manipulated.
Definitely.
And, you know, I'm not one of the players doing it, but if I could be, I would be. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, that's what I think.
Yeah, according to legend, actually, the first 1K Bitcoin valuation was basically like an organized, not a pump and dump, but basically it was kind of much more, it wasn't as organic as it appeared to be. Like, I think a lot of people were like, let's push it like up to that valuation. And I think that type of stuff happens all the time. There's a concerted effort to get Dogecoin to $1. So I think, I don't know.
But I just feel like we need to start having disclaimers when media outlets start talking about this stuff. Because like, let's not forget how many people took out loans to get some GameStop stock and then ended up freaking defaulting on their mortgages or goodness knows what. Like, please, people, like, your capital is at risk.
Absolutely. And I think we look at things on too short of a time frame. Like, we're like, oh, what's my return in the last like a year or 18 months? You got to look at it like, what's my return in 40 years, like 50 years, when I'm going to need this money set aside?
Minimum
like,
20 years.
And markets are volatile. Like, you might be that genius that times it right. You might pick the top of the market and get out. But mathematically, statistically speaking, that's not likely to be you. Like, do you know what I mean? But it's hard. People are watching.
100%.
People are watching other people get rich. That's the thing. People are watching their neighbor get rich, their friend get rich, and they want to get in. Like, I've had conversations with people who are just like, oh, I put in, you know, tens of thousands and now I've got hundreds of thousands. Do you know what I'm saying? And like, this is not like some crypto whiz genius who understands the blockchain. This is just random Joe Schmo who you maybe went to school with. And you're just thinking, rah, like, I mean, it hasn't really impacted me because I'm a bit more knowledgeable, but I know other people who all of a sudden now, you know, they want to be, you know, I don't know what they're trying to be. They're trying to be Elon. I don't know what they're trying to be. I can't think of the person because there is no crypto person I can base this on.
Kim Kardashian.
I don't know what they're trying to be. They're trying to be rich as quickly as possible. And more power to them. But yeah.
No, I actually think it's really worth like highlighting the fact that there's a bit of an ethical minefield when it comes to personal finance and investing, because what I'm noticing more and more are like investor influencers coming up in places like Clubhouse or doing Twitter threads and presenting themselves like some kind of like prophet of the get rich quick life. And people are listening to those people and taking that as like dogma, you know, like a word. Literally on the day that Coinbase went public last week, I was in a Clubhouse room and this person was just like, oh, you know, you're better off buying Bitcoin than buying Coinbase because of this, because of that, because of whatever. And I was just like, okay, like you clearly have a lot of Bitcoin. Like it benefits you to drive that price up. But this person was like preaching almost, you know what I mean? Like speaking with such an authority. And I was like, at the end of the day, who the hell are you?
It's a religion, bruv.
You're just a person trying to like sell, yeah, like you said, this dream of getting rich quickly. And I think, I don't know, I think we need to be really wary of it. And it's great on the one hand that financial literacy is on the up and access to capital markets is increasing through technology. But if it doesn't come with an education and a conversation about the risks, then, you know, it's kind of scary. You know, don't get me wrong. What's the upside? Bloomberg did an amazing article on the acceleration of the creation of Black wealth in Black communities and actually talked about how, you know, Black people, especially millennials and Gen Z, are using this time to catch up, right? They got to catch up. They got to play catch up. And I think that's great. But we just got to, like, as always, just be aware of like this balance and remember that there are unfortunately some people who are risking what they cannot afford to risk. And that is terrifying.
And the scary thing about that phrase catch up is like, if you're in a race to catch up, you got to drive faster. Mm-hmm. And that makes you more likely to crash. Do you know what I'm saying? And then when you crash, you got to start again. So I hope that doesn't happen. Yeah, it's mad. I do think it is. This is almost like a quasi-religion for some of these crypto people. And it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. The more they get more converts, the more it becomes true. So that's why you see people like just really going all in and just like, they don't want to hear no dissenters. They don't want to hear no dissent. You know what I mean? Anyways.
That reminds me, I once read this really good quote. You know when you read a good quote and you're like, I'm going to remember that quote. That's such a good quote. And the quote is, make money your god and it will plague you like the devil.
Ooh, bars. You know what? Because we don't know who came up like with that quote, we can just say that was your quote. So we're going to say that's an Abadesi quote from now on in.
We got to
copyright that, patent that, get that in a new book. You know what I'm saying?
I probably read it on the side of a bus in Nigeria or something in Lagos. Who knows?
Yeah, but you know what? One last message on this whole investment world. I definitely think people need to realize there's two different types of investments. There's the investment where you're looking for the next sucker. So gold, crypto, you're buying it because you think it will go up in price that you can sell it to the next person. Then there are investments that are cash flow generating that can actually provide you with something. So if you've got farmland that gives you, you know, whatever, that gives you chicken and eggs that can produce, you can sell. If you have a business that gives you a dividend, if you've got real estate or property that can give you rental income, right? Those are the investments that traditionally people have used to kind of retire over the long periods of time. This whole like, yo, let me like buy this thing and it's going to go up in value because it's just hype, hype, hype. It can work. And sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Just so be aware of the risk. You know what I'm saying?
Diversify.
Diversify your bonds.
This episode is sponsored by Movable Ink. Movable Ink activates any data into real time. Personalized content for over 700 of the world's most innovative brands. Movable Ink is one of the fastest growing SaaS companies in the US and is recognized by Inc. magazine's best workplaces in 2020 and 2019. They are hiring on pocketjobs.com and the link is in the show notes to apply.
So basically, people, beware, whatever country you're in. Turns out corporate espionage, as well as just plain old government espionage, is going next level now. So the UK has joined a number of other countries, US, China, warning professionals on LinkedIn against foreign spies targeting them with access to sensitive information. So the story goes, more and more of us are working from home, which means we now have like VPN, which means we can now log in to any and every system. A lot of these systems have very sensitive data, whether that's a code base, whether that's, I don't know, security keys, whether that's financial information.
Yeah.
And it looks like some sophisticated type of espionage is now like building a relationship with a professional in the company who has access to said sensitive materials. And then like offering them something enticing to establish a rapport and then elicit that information from them. Wow. So you might be like organizing a conference paying them $10,000. What's going to be the content of their presentation and their talk? And I just like, this is crazy because there's going to be a story one day, like a film or a show about the person that got scammed into revealing like company secrets. Mm. Through a LinkedIn cold request. And I was just like, wow, like what's that going to be called? Like
the in-mail.
You know what? It wouldn't surprise me like if spies like pretend to be like romantic interests, people who are like high execs at like fan companies and just be like, oh, let me date you, like Facebook super high level person. I'm really interested in your personality. Like, and then just tell me everything about what's going on. I'm not gonna lie, I think I would make a good
that happened.
I would be a good head of like a spy service, because I would think of, I would, people are stupid, especially guys as well. You'd just be like, oh yeah, this is a really attractive woman out of your league. Ideas. Yeah, who's this woman out of your league? Like, yeah, just tell her everything about what it's like to work at a fang company. Yeah, it doesn't surprise
me. That is hilarious.
None of this surprises me though. And you know what? It doesn't even have to be this nefarious. I remember maybe two, 3 years ago, I had a conversation with a large company that was like, oh, maybe we'll acquire you. I was like, I don't want to sell, you know, I'm not interested, but let's have a conversation. Let me see if you're going to throw some crazy numbers at me that might make me pause at least. Yeah, they literally were just pumping me for information. I was like, wow, I'm not comfortable with this, you know, at all. They were like, so what's your you know, what's your customer acquisition cost, what's your sales, what's this, what's that, what's this? And I left that meeting thinking to myself, wow, they played me. You know what I'm saying? Because there was no guarantee that anything would come of it. There was no guarantee that even if they were serious, that they were going to proceed, right? And they walked out of that meeting with enough info to be like, A, there's an opportunity here. B, let's clone him.
Yeah.
And C, like, he's a fool. You know what I mean? So be careful if you're a founder or anyone who's got any kind of, you know, position of knowledge that you don't want to, you know, you've got knowledge that you don't want to give out. People can come at you in different ways. It could be conferences. It could be, you know, I'm saying a podcast interview. Oh my Lord, I completely forgot. There was a podcaster that was doing that. Do you remember? There was a podcaster that was interviewing people, pumping them for information. It wasn't a government thing, but he was...
Oh, the podcast never came out. Someone did that to me.
No, it wasn't the podcast never came out, but basically he would take that information and then like consult other rival companies, or like he would use that information against them. Yeah, like in a nefarious way. And we live in this world of transparency. That's so dark. Like Gary Vee, like, you know, oh yeah, just be open, like share your plan, share your vision. Like everything is content. So a lot of people got suckered into kind of giving out sensitive information, you know what I'm saying, about their startup. And yeah, be careful out here, man. Be careful.
Damn. I do remember once someone was like, oh, I want to interview for my podcast. He's like, oh, so how do you approach your clients? Oh, and like, what's the most compelling argument? And I was just like, damn, son, you're just trying to get my strategy. Yeah. It's like, if you wanted to know, you could have just asked. You didn't have to like, but I like said it. I was just like, dude, if you want to know, you can just ask. You don't need to like have this front of doing a podcast.
And then
they're like,
out.
backtrack. Yeah, yeah. They're just like, oh, no, yeah. Let me go do some more general questions. I'll be more relevant for the podcast audience. Podcast never dropped.
Oh,
podcast
Lord.
Never dropped.
Lord have mercy.
Yeah, man. Sad. People are just, I don't know.
Did you not do any homework though? Did you see if they had a genuine podcast, or was it just like, you just...
Dude, I know this person. So this person like runs a social enterprise, like a very like, established one. It had run some programs, but this is just someone that, you know, as it turns out, a representative of the dominant groups, you know, this is a person from the dominant groups. And I think, you know, they didn't quite have the empathy and the understanding of the way the world was changing to really realize that what they were doing was like so not cool. And other things happened after that, just in terms of like how this particular individual interacted with Black female founders. I know that just made me realize, ah, do you know what? I can't even be bothered, because this person is just going to like learn the hard way. You know what I mean?
So basically,
like, this is someone who has a bit of a history of like being duplicitous.
So basically, from what I gathered from what you said, so there was a white person who's running a social enterprise that you're kind of competing with slightly. They were feeling like the market's shifting. Everyone's kind of going from this more intersectional approach. I'm kind of slipping.
Exactly.
Let me interview Abdesi. Yeah. Pretend it's a podcast and just pump you for information. Yeah. Lord have mercy.
Yeah.
How could you not put that person
so
on blast?
Sad.
I would have blasted them so badly.
No, because do you know what? Do you know what's so funny? So interestingly, other people that collaborated with this particular person kind of spoke out against their ill behavior.
Got
and
you.
What I decided to do was to amplify them. So I was like, I don't need to speak out my own thing, but let me amplify them. So when those people started telling their stories, I started amplifying those, retweeting, whatever. This person now attacked me over email. And do you know what? I was just like, the best thing I can do is to not respond. And I think about that now, because I was like, I never replied. And that person then reached out to me like a year or two later, like about something else. And I was just like, you've just fallen into the bucket of people I don't even honor with a reply. So
wow,
bye.
That is you should write a book about that. I'm not gonna lie.
The power of silence.
We love it.
I was just gonna say, final thing, you don't have to answer questions that people ask you. This is the thing, like, okay, fair enough, you're like pitching to an investor and they want to know your like CAC or whatever, LTV. Yeah, okay, know that. But you don't have to tell, you don't have to answer stuff that you don't want to. And I see this, you know, social media is like, and look, don't get me wrong, like if I put a post on Instagram, I do try to make it as heartfelt as possible and like really try to share a reflection that I feel will resonate with like the people in my community that need to hear that, women of color in particular. But at the same time, like I see this like, really just frustrating and like honestly disgusting trend where algorithms love trauma. Algorithms love, oh my God, this happened to me and then this and now like, you know, but I'm gonna be better. I've overcome it. I've this, I've that. We are now being encouraged to expose our pain, our suffering, to maximize engagement. And it's often women and other marginalized people. And I just think like it's really unhealthy and we need to stop. And we just need to like, again, have some discipline and reaffirm our boundaries and just be like, I'm happy to share as far as this, but the rest of it, no, that's me. That's for my life. That's not for me to put out into the public sphere. And the same is true of like business down. Like if you got stuff, that's your secret sauce. Ain't nobody gonna know about that. Mm. I don't know how to make KFC chicken. I don't know how to make Coca-Cola.
Yeah, like, that's real.
Fine.
I think it's those companies have such so much money though that they can market themselves in other ways. But when you're kind of starting out and you're penniless, all you have is your story. And the crazier your story is, the more attention it will get. And I mean, the more out of the quote unquote media norm, I'm using air quotes, there is no norm. Do you know what I'm saying? But if something has happened to you that is quote unquote outside of the norm, there is a pressure to kind of expose that and expose your story so that you get traction. Do you know what I'm saying? To be like, oh, this happened to me, this happened
but
to me.
But maybe we need new stories. But then maybe we need new stories because that is always the trend. That's always a trend with underrepresented founders. Look, I'm like 5 years into running Hustle Crew. It's like, oh, what's the origin story? Everyone wants to know the origin story. I completely get that. But then you tell a story that's actually like deeply affected your psyche so many times, it no longer becomes a memory. You know what I mean? Like it just becomes a friggin' marketing campaign. And what actually happens to your memory of that? Because that's part of your life and your legacy and your experience of the world and your, I don't know, spirituality, like the way you were impacted by the events that sent you off on that entrepreneurial journey. And I just think we have to be willing to like, yes, share the origin story, but share a version of it that still protects what is sacred to us. So that doesn't become another thing that's dissected by random strangers in the public.
Yeah, just know what you're comfortable with. It's ironic because I think the one episode that we always get flagged up about is when like, I think we were really vulnerable one episode. This is when we used to record in person. And I think I was talking about ego and you were talking about just being a broke founder and people were like, oh my God, like the episode was so amazing and whatever. Like, but we don't always go there because it's like, we don't have to. Do you know what I'm saying? We've got other things to talk about. And while it is great that people can relate to it and they appreciate it, you can't do that every episode. Do you know, it's not possible kind of thing. Because otherwise, what's left for us? Do you know what I'm saying? And what's left for our therapist? Like, how are therapists going to earn money if they can't?
Exactly. I got to say something for that.
I got to pay someone to hear this shit, man. I can't think now, but it's difficult because Dr. Tissid, we probably helped a lot of people. Like, there was probably a lot of people that heard that episode and was like, I can relate. And I thought I was alone. So it's a balance you've got to strike. Do you know what I'm saying? I'm not saying never share anything vulnerable. I mean, you love Brené Brown.
I'm still working on it.
That's a whole shtick. Isn't that Brené Brown's whole shtick? Like vulnerability, there's power in that. Like, and you love her.
I love that woman. She is amazing. But she herself said that after she did her TED Talk, she had a vulnerability hangover. And she's spoken about this in her work. She said, vulnerability doesn't come without a cost. Yes, there's a lot to gain. Deeper, more authentic human connection. People will be vulnerable in return, hopefully, if you model that behavior and establish trust. But it doesn't come without a cost, and that cost is a vulnerability hangover. You feel exposed.
Right.
You're like, wow, I really laid my soul bare. And this is the thing that I'm saying. Like, I reached a point now with the Hustle Crew story where people are like, oh, so tell me why you started Hustle Crew. I was just like, really? Do I have to go back there for you? Like, don't you already know? And like, now I'm just like so desensitized to the narrative because it's just like, yeah, then this, then that, then whatever. And cool, boom. Yeah. So people were racist and sexist to me, but here I am, la-di-da. Like, I don't know. It's just interesting. And I think, you know, I'm reaching that point now where it's just like, I need to find a way to tell the story where it's still, you know, inspiring, but not almost diminishing what was ultimately an extremely traumatic period in my life.
It's review time. Thank you to Lauren. Lauren 06. She left this review saying, incredible. Hearing two young black perspectives is the best way to end my Friday. Abadesi and Michael are knowledgeable, honest, and accessible. They remind me of a younger, woker, and obviously black Karis Fisher and Scott Galloway from Pivot. Do yourself a favor, follow the podcast.
Wow.
Let me say something, yeah?
That's high praise.
No, that's not high praise because we started our podcast first before Karis Fisher and Scott Galloway, so I don't really appreciate that. Like, the black version of something. Why can't they be the white version of us? Why are we the black version of something? What? Come on, man. Nah.
We're the originators.
Yeah, what are the originators?
They probably listened to this podcast and then were like, do you know what? We need to do our own version. Yeah. Anyway, we're funnier than them.
Yeah, we are. You know what? Nah, I'm joking. In all seriousness, I appreciate the view. Shout out to Lauren for listening, man. We're doing our thing. Peace.
Yeah. Represent.
Yo, everyone, thank you for listening. That's been this week's Techish. Leave your reviews if you want to get read out on the show. Techish. Follow us at Techish Pod on Instagram and Twitter, and then sub to our Patreon for some extra content, extra-ish, coming your way. All right, peace. Ciao.
Make sure you follow us, too. Follow Michael Berhane, Abadesi.
Yeah, we're here too. Peace. Bye. Bye.